On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Mining Waste Treatment Technology Selection. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Mining Waste Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's call. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then turn the training over to our trainers from the ITRC Mining Waste Team. As listed on the slide, today's training is based on the ITRC web-based technical and regulatory guidance document. And we're going to introduce you to this document during today's training class. And we do encourage you to review the web-based tool after the training class. And we'll take you to a link at the ending where you can access that. We also make available the presentation to download. You'll see during the training class information on the slides. In our downloaded version, we have additional information in the notes section. And again, at the end of the training, we're going to take you to a link where you can access the ITRC web-based document as well as the training slides. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and it's hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. Moving to slide two, if you're unfamiliar with this version of CLUIN, it's a series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate, and most often you're going to use the third button, the single right arrow. The slide number is listed in the upper left-hand corner, and the trainers are going to say the slide number throughout today's training class. Each of you in the audience are in control of your own slides. Today's course is scheduled for 2.25 hours. We'll have question and answer breaks, one in the middle and another at the end. To send in a question for the simulcast audience, it's the orange question mark at the top of the slide that allows you to send in questions. And anyone is welcome to send in a question at any time during today's training. For our phone line audience, you also have the opportunity to ask questions out loud, and we'll remind you how to unmute. We do ask that you hold those questions until the question and answer breaks. On our last slide, we have a link to our feedback form, and we do look for everyone on the call to fill out that feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. Today's training is being recorded, and we offer archives of past ITRC training classes. We have over 60 archives of ITRC classes. There's many more archives from other people who offer classes on CLUIN, so visit the CLUIN website to see more. On slide three, more information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, which is listed at the top of this slide. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. It's a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of technical and regulatory guidance documents, as well as internet-based, and we also have classroom training as well. On slide four, I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers were members of the ITRC Mining Waste Team. Sherry Basinger is the administrator for the Section of Epidemiology for the Public Health Practices in Jefferson City, Missouri. She oversees environmental health activities occurring throughout the state, including around Missouri's current and historic lead mine sites. Paul Eager is a volunteer for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. He is a pioneer in the use of wetlands to remove trace metals from mine drainage, and much of his work is focused on the development of successful passive treatment systems to control mine drainage problems. Doug Bacon works for the Utah Department of Environmental Quality located in Salt Lake City. His responsibilities include overseeing the CERCLA and state natural resource damage claim response actions at the Kennecott South and North zones. On slide five, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Sherry Basinger at the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services. Sherry?
Thank you, Juliana. And just to make sure I've unmuted my phone correctly, right?
Yes, you have. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. I'd like to start out today by telling you a little bit about the team that developed the mining technology selection guidance. We were a fairly diverse team of about 35 participants. We were about evenly divided between state government regulators, federal employees of federal agencies, and private industry. We also had a couple of academicians, some public stakeholders, and we had some international participation also. So the team, in 2007, we put out a white paper that briefly discussed mining issues in the states that were participating in the team. Then in 2010, we put out the Mining Technology Selection Guidance. That's the guidance document that we'll be talking about today. And then as a result of some of our discussions about the technologies that we can use to clean up mine sites, one of those technologies engendered a lot of discussion during our development of this guidance. That was biochemical reactors. So the team chose to go ahead and form another team to look at biochemical reactors. And as Juliana said, we will be doing a training on biochemical reactors on Thursday of this week. So if that's something you're interested in, please sign up and participate in the training. Now, I would like to move on to slide number 6. For those of you who work with mining sites, I'm sure you know that mine waste is a burning issue at any of these sites. The photo on this slide is underground oxidation, which is occurring in a coal mine in Venezuela. Moving on to slide number 7. At the top of the slide, we have the website that is the website for the guidance document that we'll be talking about. If you would like to go ahead and open that guidance up, I would recommend that you open it up in a new window so you can keep the clue-in window open and then the guidance open and flip back and forth between the two of them. But the guidance that we're going to be talking about today is basically a quick tool where a user can go in, know something about their site, and identify all in one place some technologies that might be appropriate for cleaning up their site. Because everything is together in one place, it's one of those kinds of tools that saves time and saves money for those project managers. The guidance applies to any and all potentially impacted media. So it deals with soil, it deals with mine waste, chats, fines, tailings. It deals with mining influence water, whether it's groundwater, surface water, mine pits, all that sort of stuff. The technologies that we talk about are applicable to all of those. The guidance was built on case studies, and those case studies are included in the guidance. So you've got access to case studies where the technologies have been used already. And if you've ever had a new employee that's coming in to work on mining sites, you know that they're huge, you know that they're daunting, you know that it can be a little bit overwhelming. This guidance document has all kinds of stuff that would be a great training tool for new employees because it talks a little bit about what are issues related to mining, how the technologies we can use to clean them up, the thought process behind why would you select this or that. So it's a great training tool for new employees. And then we also talk about some potential regulatory constraints and maybe some innovative ways to overcome those constraints. Okay, moving on to slide number 8. This is kind of the roadmap of what we're going to talk about today. First of all, I will briefly touch on some mining issues, and then I'll give you a very brief overview of the guidance document. Then I'm going to turn it over to Paul Eager, who is going to use the Duncan Mine as a case study for how you go through the decision trees in the guidance document. And then Doug is going to take the Bingham Mine and use that as a case study to go through how you would further refine your choices using the technology overviews and the case studies that are in the guidance. On slide number 9, what we would like you to get out of this training today, basically, we'd like you to have a very, glazy kind of understanding of issues related to mining waste. We would like you to know, in general, what's in this guidance and how do you use it. Okay, moving on to slide number 10. Obviously, mining is important to our economy. We need the metals, we need the minerals, we need the fuels that are mined to support the lifestyle that we have right now. As a matter of fact, if you drive around in southern Missouri for any period of time, you're going to see a red bumper sticker with white letters that says, if it can't be grown, it's got to be mined. On the other hand, mining is a pretty messy business. Over 90% of the material that's brought up from a mine is waste material. This creates some very large volumes of waste material sitting on the surface, solid mining waste. Then historically, we haven't reclaimed that. We haven't restored those areas. So that leaves us with some fairly significant environmental and human health issues related to exposure to those solid mining wastes. The current regulatory solutions that we have to deal with these mine wastes are expensive, and they take a very long time to implement, and that's generally not acceptable to the public, to the regulators, or to the regulated community. Now, if we move on to slide number 11, most mining sites tend to be pretty good-sized sites. They can cover anywhere from hundreds of acres to hundreds of square miles. You can have a single mining site, like the Annapolis Lead Mine, which is a relatively small site. It's less than 1 square mile, but there's 1.1 million tons of mining waste that were deposited in a ravine on that particular site. Or you can have something as big as the Anaconda Superfund site, which is about 300 square miles. It's a mining and smelting complex. And the top photo on this slide shows the smelter stack at the Anaconda mine when it was operating. But both of these sites, both Annapolis and Anaconda, have solid mining waste and have mining-influenced water that have affected the uplands in the area, wetlands in the area, groundwater, streams, soils, and down to the residents and the biota also. You can also have mining areas or mining districts where you have lots and lots of little mines in an area. An example of that is shown in the bottom picture on this slide. There's sort of a map of kind of central east Missouri that has outlined in pink some mining districts that we have, the old lead belt and the new lead belt. And in these areas, we've had mining, milling, and smelting that have gone on for over 100 years. The area covers about 200 square miles, and it's just dotted with hundreds of little mines throughout the area. On top of the hundreds of mines on surface, we have, actually underneath the hundreds of mines on the surface, we have about 1,000 miles of abandoned mine tunnels with about 300 miles of abandoned underground rail lines. And again, in this area, you know, we've got soil that's been affected by exposure to mine waste. We've got air, water, biota, and again, residents, all of which have been affected by exposure to the mine waste. On slide number 12, pretty much any media you can come up with could be possibly affected by mine waste. You could have air, water, soil, or vegetation. If you look at photo number 1, that shows fine tailings that are blowing off the Elvins and River Mines pile located in Missouri's old lead belt in southeast Missouri. And when basically you have wind that blows across these areas, picks up the fine tailings, as they blow across, people or environmental or biota could be exposed to the metals that are associated with those tailings through inhalation. And then once the tailings are deposited further away off-site, people or biota could again be exposed to those to the metals in those tailings through incidental ingestion. Photo number 2 on this slide shows typical red acid mine drainage. Acid mine drainage is caused when water flows either over or through sulfur-bearing materials and forms solutions of net acidity. Acid mine drainage can dissolve and transport heavy metals like lead or copper or cadmium into groundwater, surface water. Again, this becomes an issue when you have organisms living in it or when those water bodies are used for drinking water. Photos 3 and 4 on this slide show, photo 3 is the fine tailings area at the base of the National Tailings Pile, again located in Missouri's old lead belt. And photo number 4 is the historic Bingham and Garfield Rail Corridor. And this is the rail line that transported ores from the Bingham Pit Mine to the smelters north of Copperton, Utah. And in these two photos, you can see that you've got some real patchy vegetation. You can't really see that you've got high metals concentration in the soils there, but you can see that the vegetation is very patchy. And moving on to slide number 13. In doing this guidance and creating the guidance, we basically divided most of the mine waste that we have out into solid mining waste or mining-influenced waters. Solid mining waste includes things like mine pits or workings, waste rock stockpiles, tailings, chat, other mining waste, you know, fines or slimes, whatever, smelter waste like slag or clinker or whatever, or any other kind of stuff, any other solid mining waste. Now, all of these wastes contain residual metals or other chemicals that were associated with the mining or associated with the ore body, and now that the mining wastes are up on the surface, they're available for exposure to either humans or biota. And these solid mining waste can cover hundreds and hundreds of square miles. We've got two examples here on this slide. The top photo is a photo of mine tailings that are kind of spilling out of an adit in a mine in in Colorado. In the bottom photo, you can see the kind of tannish hill in the background. at the chat pile located, it's called the National Pile. It's located in Missouri's old lead belt outside of Park Hills, Missouri. So moving on to slide number 14. The other type of mine waste that we talk about in the guidance is mining-influenced water. Mining-influenced water can either be acidic, it can be basic, or it can be circumneutral, meaning it has a pH around 7. Particularly if mining-influenced water is acidic, it can have unacceptably high levels of cyanide or metals in it. Nationwide, there are over 10,000 stream miles that have been affected by mining-influenced water, and in other areas, we have groundwater that's affected by mining-influenced water. This is particularly an issue if that groundwater is used as a drinking water source. The photo on this slide shows pretty typical red acid mine drainage from a mine in Minnesota. On slide number 15, the objectives of the guidance that we put together is, first of all, to help the user select appropriate technologies for their particular site and situation. Second, to provide information on those technologies to help you decide if they are appropriate or not. And third and most important, to get some of these mine waste sites cleaned up. Photos on this slide are the Flambeau Mine in Wisconsin, which was mined between 1993 and 1997. And during its operating time, the Flambeau Mine produced 181,000 tons of copper, 334,000 ounces of gold, and 3.3 million ounces of silver. Moving on to slide number 16. When we started putting this, well, when the team first got together, we were kind of thinking and debating, what do we want to do with this team? How are we going to put together a guidance document? What's the biggest need that we have out there? And the biggest need that we identified is that there's really no one place where somebody that's interested in cleaning up a mine site could go and say, what are the possibilities here? You know, I've got this big complicated site. I've got all kinds of media that are contaminated. How on earth am I going to deal with it? So we decided that we would take that particular problem and fill that particular gap. We would put together a guidance document that could help a user look at their site, take what they know about their site, answer some questions, and say, hey, here are some potential technologies that you can use to clean up this site. It helps you organize your thought processes as you're going through, and then you can, it helps make decisions in the end on what type of technology you're going to use to clean up the site. On slide number 17, we decided to make this a web-based guidance for a couple of reasons. One, we could be a little bit more interactive with the guidance. We could have decision tables. We could have some clicking around. It's a little bit easier, less cumbersome to use than a paper guidance document would have been. We can use a lot more pictures, which we all like pictures, and it's going to be easier to update in the future. Moving on to slide number 18, what all is in the guidance? First thing we have, obviously, is an overview of mining issues. Then we have the heart and soul of the guidance, which is the sets of decision trees that we have in it. And then at the end of the decision trees, that's going to take you to some potential technologies. We have overviews of each one of the technologies that we talked about in the guidance document. I think there are 22 technology overviews in there. Then all of the guidance really was built on case studies. What technologies have been used, how well did they work, is this the appropriate situation or not. All those case studies are also present in the guidance document. Then we also have sections that talk about regulatory issues and stakeholder concerns. And finally, we have links to additional resources. On slide number 19, this is just a screenshot of the opening page for the guidance document. It's like any other website. We've got sidebar navigation, so you don't have to read straight through the document. You can flip around where you want to go. There's an orange rectangle up at the top that allows you to click in and sign in for internet-based training at Clue-In, like some of you guys may have done today. We also have the option to print each page as a PDF. There is no link to print the whole guidance document. It's absolutely huge. I wouldn't recommend doing that. But if you wanted to print any one of the pages in here, one of the technology overviews or case studies, there's a link for you to do that. Page 19 is a screenshot just at the bottom of the page. And, again, we've got back navigation in the footer. We've got contact information for ITRC and for the team leads. And then there's a link to all the fine print, ITRC's disclaimer, privacy and usage policies. Okay, so on slide number 21, This is the opening page of one of the decision trees. As you know, mining sites can have contaminated groundwater, they can have contaminated soil, they can have contaminated streams. There's all kinds of different issues that you're going to come across in trying to clean up a mining site. So what we tried to do with the decision tree is started off with, do you need to make a decision right now? Right now being in the governmental 2 years. Or do you have a little bit more time in which to make your decision? So that would be the first question you're going to have to answer. And then from there, you can click on the dark boxes at the bottom, and that'll take you to the appropriate part of the decision tree. Slide number 22. Okay, what I'm going to do is to show you some screenshots of the decision trees. I don't expect you to read through them now. I don't expect you to know what's in them. I'm not even going to talk at that level. I'm just going to give you kind of the high level what's included on this. Paul is going to walk you through the decision trees and show you some of the questions that you would be answering. Okay, so slide number 22 is just screenshots of the immediate decision tree, and you'll notice that on each one of these things we have a couple of navigation aids. First of all, the titles, like immediate decision tree, part one and part two, so you know kind of if you're at the top of the tree or at the bottom of the tree and which tree you're on. So that gives you one clue. But then the second thing that we have is up in the corner under the printer-friendly version button, there's what we call the You Are Here diagram, and that's a schematic of all the decision trees with the part that you're on highlighted. And that is live so that you can click back and forth if you know you're over here in the bottom of the immediate decision tree and you know you want to go to the bottom of the water decision tree. You can just click over there and it'll take you there. Slide number 23 is screenshots of the solid mining waste decision tree. And what you'll notice is that as you go down and as you answer questions and get farther down into the decision trees, the color boxes behind with the questions in them get a little bit darker as you go down. The final box, or what we call the bucket of technologies box, is a dark green or dark blue box, and it has white lettering on it. The white lettering is, those are all individual technologies that might be used. If you click on any one of those, they're just a link to the technology overview. Slide number 24 are screenshots of the mining influence water decision tree. And at some places in the decision trees, you need to go from, say, maybe the water decision tree back to the solid mining waste decision tree. You can see kind of some dotted lines on these two decision trees. That'll, if you click on that, the text at the end of that, that'll take you back to the appropriate decision tree, and there's a big orange triangle that says, come in here. So those are some helps for you. A note about color in general, if the color is blue, you're dealing with mining influence water. If it's green, you're dealing with solid mining waste. And like I said earlier, color gets darker as you go through the decision trees. On slide number 25, it's a screenshot of one of the technology overviews. The focus of the technology overviews is to provide information on newer technologies, information on novel uses of conventional technologies, and then provide links to the case studies and other references where appropriate. Each technology overview in the guidance document consists of an introduction, so we, you know, general stuff about that particular technology. And we have a section on applicability, where can you use it, where shouldn't you use it. We have a section on advantages, what are the pluses of it, and then anytime you list advantages, you need to have limitations too. Where we have information available, we have information on performance and cost considerations. Then we've also got sections on regulatory considerations, stakeholder considerations, public acceptance. We've got some lessons learned. And then links to the case studies that were used to develop that technology overview, as well as outside references. On slide number 26, there are 22 different technology overviews that we have in the guidance document. They're all listed on this slide. The ones that have a red asterisk at the end of the technology name are ones that ITRC has a guidance document on. We have a brief summary of that in our guidance with a link to the whole guidance document. Now, I would like to make sure that you know that these technology overviews are just that. They're technology overviews. They are not how-to manuals. They are not how-to guidances. We partnered with a couple of outside groups. The Acid Drainage Technology Initiative, or ADTI, and the International Network for Acid Prevention, or INAF, to make sure that we were not duplicating their efforts. They have some guidance documents that are much more how-to guidances. We have links to those guidances for you in our guidance document. Okay, on slide number 27, this is a screenshot of a case study. Looks very much like a technology overview, but it has different information in it. First thing that you'll see in a in the case study is some site information, where the site's located, what was mined, and most importantly, who's a contact person, where you can find more information on that site. We've got information on the different remedial actions and technologies that were used at the site. If we have it, we've got some information on performance and cost. We've got sections that talk about the regulatory and the stakeholder challenges that were experienced in working on these sites, and then some lessons learned, and then there are also references again. On slide number 28, this is a map that shows the distribution of the case studies that we used in developing the guidance document. You'll see they're pretty well scattered out across the U.S. We have a couple in Canada also. There's a total of 59 case studies that were used in developing this guidance. Page 29, or slide number 29, we do have a section on regulatory issues. We talk about things like water quality standards and maybe some potential flexibilities for that you can use in water quality standards. We also talk a little bit about solid mining waste issues, like can you land apply it or not, reuse, reprocessing, doing things like reducing bioavailability instead of cleaning up the waste, and treatment and closure in place. On slide number 30, we also have a section that talks about stakeholder concerns, because anytime you work in mining sites, it's a very, you get that interesting juxtaposition of this is my history and my heritage and, oh my goodness, look at this pile of waste. And so we have a little bit of discussion about balancing public health and the ecology with, you know, people's work history and work heritage. So on slide number 31, what I'd like to do, you know, to summarize my section and say, basically, we're going to, you know, we've produced a web-based guidance. That should help you choose, any user choose an appropriate technology for use in cleaning up a mining site. In order to use the guidance document, we do assume that the site has been characterized. We don't talk about characterizing the site, but we assume that you know what kind of waste you have, what kind of materials you have, and how people or biota could be exposed to those wastes. The guidance will help you then select appropriate technologies that can be used to remediate a mining site. Now, because mining sites are big and diverse, you have water, you have groundwater, you have solid mining waste, you may need to go through the decision tree several times to choose different remedial technologies for different parts of your site. And the technology overviews are just that. We have 22 of them. But they're not how-to guides. They're just an overview of the technology. And then you need to consider the unique site characteristics and costs associated with your particular site. In other words, your mileage may vary when using the guidance. Now, on slide number 32, I would like to turn this over to Paul Eager, who is going to use the Duncan Mine to walk you through one of the decision trees. Paul?
Thanks, Sherry. So, as Sherry mentioned, what I'm going to do is kind of use the Duncan Mine to kind of illustrate how you can use the decision trees to hopefully get you to technologies that are appropriate for your site. So, unfortunately, these decision trees were not around when I started working on the Duncan Mine, which was more years ago than I'd like to admit, but it's still a fascinating case study, and I still get excited talking about it, and that's why my daughters say, Dad, you really need a life. So let's go to slide number 33 and take a look at where this is located. So as mentioned, I am in flyover country in the great state of Minnesota, and we see the world a little bit differently than probably most people do. But, you know, have to be a little different to live in a place where it seems like it's always winter, particularly this year. So the project site is located up in the northeastern section of Minnesota, on the far eastern edge of the Mesabi Iron Range. On slide number 34, an aerial view of the Duncan Mine. Now, Minnesota produces about 75% of the nation's iron ore, all from large open pits, similar to the Duncan Mine. This pit's several miles long, it's about a half a mile wide deep, and it's about 300 feet deep. It began in the early 1960s and operated up until the mid-1990s. So it started in early 60s, okay? No Clean Water Act. Minnesota did not get mineland reclamation rules until about 1980. So they kind of did what had been done on the Iron Range since mining began back in the early 1882 is when mining began here in the Iron Range. So what do? Well, you dig a big hole in the ground, and then on slide number 35, you take any waste and you put it in big piles right next to your pit. And you make it as steep as you can and you as high as you can because, A, that's what we've always done, and we did that because it was the cheapest. So that's what they did. And, you know, we are, you know, when I used to work for the DNR, we used to joke that, well, the reason we never had any water quality problems with the iron mining is because we had such great reclamation staff. And although that was true, I mean, the main reason we didn't have problems is that it was geologically dumb luck. I mean, this is essentially from iron oxide, so we didn't have a lot of problems with water quality issues. But the Duncan Mine was a little different. And so if we go to slide number 36, you will see the engineer's version of geological maps. So, you know, engineers not only see the world in black and white, we see everything in straight lines. So, of course, all geological contacts are perfectly straight. It makes it easier for us to understand. I'm sorry to all those geologists out there. So what you see here is that the red is the Boabas Iron Formation. That is the host formation for the iron deposits in Minnesota. What's different about this particular operation is the upper right, that gray or a gray complex, which is called the Duluth Complex. And this is an igneous intrusive, and it is the host for copper, nickel, sulfide mineralization. And right now, there's a lot of interest in Minnesota in developing this for copper nickel. We're actually kind of in the process of first environmental impact statement for an open pit prospect, not very far from the Duncan pit, actually. So what happened is, though, you know, again, this is early 60s. Hey, it's just another waste drop. Yeah, there's some copper and nickel in here, but I don't think it's going to be a problem. So let's just stockpile it like we always stockpiled it. And so they did. Big piles, deep piles, close to the pit. So let's go to slide number 37. And as Sherry mentioned, you know, the problem with sulfide minerals is that they are not stable. Light oxides are stable. So you bring them up to the surface, you expose them to air, and you start to oxidize those sulfides, and you're on your way to having water quality issues. And so again, on the left is just a picture of the unoxidized fresh surface of the Duluth complex. On the right is a photo showing that the oxidation process has occurred. You can see that those complex sulfides are now starting to react, and you start to see iron oxyhydroxide forming on the surface. So the oxidation process has started. We are on the way to releasing trace metals into solution and potentially producing acid. So that's what started. So that's part of the problem here. And if we go to slide number 38, we're also in a very wet region. So northeastern Minnesota, the precipitation exceeds evapotranspiration, so we have an excess of water. We have a lot of wetlands and a lot of surface streams. And, again, there weren't any reclamation rules. There weren't any wetland conservation rules, particularly in a section of the state where You know, people joke that we need an upland conservation rule. So stockpiles were just placed near the pit. That was the prime concern. And if it meant going into a wetland, as shown here, and if it meant going across the stream, which is shown here, that was okay because it was just waste rock. Well, this is different waste rock. And so as a result, we've got reactive rock sitting right adjacent to or in water or across water. So we have a perfect storm here for having water quality problems. So let's go to slide number 39. This is a summary of the problem at Vedanta. So there were five major seeps, and these were really kind of identifiable point sources. There's obviously a lot of dispersed and diffuse flow as well from when you have stockpiles of this size. I don't think I mentioned it there. It was 50 million tons of this dilute complex stockpiled around that pit. So just a little bit of reactive material. So the flow of those distinct seeps vary anywhere from 5 up to around 250 gallons per minute. So as we used to joke, that's pretty good flow. Luckily, there is enough inherent neutralization capacity in this formation that most of the water would circumneutral. And Sherry mentioned, you know, there's a range of water quality problems and water quality types that we lump as mining instance water. There was one site that had a acidic pH. But again, as she mentioned, circumneutral pH doesn't mean you get a free pass. Some of these metals, particularly nickel, which is the primary concern at this site, are quite soluble in neutral pH, and we had anywhere from 1 to 10 milligrams per liter of trace metals, of nickel in solution, and various other trace metals, again, depending on its specific location. All right, so let's go to slide number 40. So this is a mining influence water issue. The source of the problem is the waste rock stockpile. So, now, if I had the decision trees, I would go to slide number 41, and I would start. So let's do that. And so the first thing is to go to the initial questions, and this is, do we have to do something right now? And as Sherry mentioned, that's the two-year time frame. Normally, if you've got some kind of situation that's immediately dangerous for life and health, you've got, you know, contaminated drinking water supplies, you've got people that are getting health impacts, or maybe you have acute toxicity, you have fish rolling in the lake, then you got to do something immediately. This is a remote site. There's no people living nearby. There's no either individual or public water supplies. Luckily, since it was primarily circumneutral, the receiving stream also was circumneutral, and there was aquatic life in the stream. So we had some time. So this is really we go to slide number 42. This essentially is a long term. We have some time. We have more than 2 years to actually try to solve this problem. So the next question that we ask is this a solid mining waste or a mining instance water solid? And just to kind of give you an overview here, what you'll see is that the question that we're addressing on the slide is circled, and the path that we have taken as we move through the decision tree is outlined in red. Okay, so this really is, we've got water quality in excess of standards. We have chronic toxicity concerns. This really is a water quality problem. So this is slide number 43, and we're going to enter the mining influence water decision tree. All right, so in slide number 44, this is essentially the beginning of the mining influence water decision tree, and our first question is, where do we have to control the water quality? Is it at the human receptor or is that the source? Okay, so this particular problem, as I said, it's a remote site. We're looking at doing something at the source. So we're going to move further down the tree into slide number 45. And now the question is, can we eliminate the mining influence water by addressing the solid mining waste source? Okay, and so the key word here is eliminate, and we're not going to be able to eliminate. As I mentioned, there are 50 million tons of this stuff. They were built in a manner to facilitate, you know, easy disposal and low cost, not to do any kind of long-term reclamation. So there was nothing we could do here to actually eliminate the problem by addressing the source. So let's go on slide number 46. So the answer to eliminating the problem was no, and for now, is this a surface water quality problem or a groundwater quality problem? So I showed you the photo of the stockpile in the wetland and over the stream. Again, groundwater is very close, if not at surface, in most of this site. So most of the water is entering the groundwater, the surface water system directly. Water that does enter the groundwater quickly reports to the surface water. So essentially this whole site is being really managed based on the surface water. All right, so let's continue going further down the tree onto slide number 47. And now the question is, okay, if we've got to deal with the surface water, we're going to have to treat it. What kind of technology do we want to use? Do we want to use something that's passive or something that's active? And so let's go to slide 48, and we'll talk about what those two terms mean. And so we couldn't agree, of course, as a team what they meant, so we decided to steal from somebody else. And with plagiarizing with credit, so we think this is okay. This is what scientists and engineers do all the time when we reference somebody. So Sherry mentioned this International Network Acid Prevention, which is INAP, and one of those things they produced was this Global Acid Rock Drainage Guide, or GARD guide. So, you know, people work for the government, we love acronyms, so. And this is an industrial group, and they're just as big into acronyms as we used to be, so yeah, I don't know, go figure. But active technologies are kind of what we think about generally when we think about water treatment. This is like, you know, our sewage treatment plants, our drinking water plants, and that's what's shown in that upper right photo. It's your standard big box kind of treatment plant. And, you know, I admit it, I'm an engineer, and well, this is the thing we learned to design in engineering schools, but it's great. I mean, you can put on all sorts of bells and whistles, and now we've got all sorts of computer control. I mean, we can monitor this stuff from home now, and so this is pretty cool, and they work really well. I mean, the problem is that they're really expensive, and they take a lot of staff to run, and you're constantly putting in energy and chemicals. So, again, they work great, but there's some downsides, and mine drainage problems last a very long time. This is not short-term treatment. Once these problems start, you know, they persist. There's actually some very interesting mine drainage that dates back to the Romans, and so this is insane, 2,000 years, and we're still getting acid mine drainage. So it's kind of like the Energizer Bunny. It just keeps going. So those of us who work in the field and have kind of become passive treatment advocates really think we need a different approach. And, you know, we like to argue, and I believe this is what I do, so that it really is a more holistic approach. That we're trying to figure out, okay, can we do this in a more natural manner? Can we use natural mechanisms, natural materials? Can we use gravity flow to get adequate treatment? And so the poster child for passive treatment is shown in the lower right, which is a wetland. And as Sherry mentioned, you know, ICRC has done a series of guidance documents, and we did one on constructive treatment wetland, and there is a section in that document that deals with mining issues specifically. So again, it's a very good reference to go back to. All right, so enough of my soapbox on why passive treatment is great. So let's go to slide number 49. The company decided on passive treatment. So, and the reason they did that is highlighted on slide number 50, and it's all about cost. So you can see how long I have been working on this project. So this was from 1986 cost figures, and it's broken down into capital and O&M costs. And, you know, none of these are cheap. I mean, this is a big site. So, you know, it's $4 to $8 million, regardless of whether you do passive or active. But the big difference is in the annual operation and maintenance costs. So the passive technologies was projected to have about $1 million a year savings over comparable active treatments. And so, again, when you think about this is a long-term problem, the difference in O&M costs is a very big deal. And so the company said, we definitely want to look at passive treatment here. So let's go to slide number 51. So they're going into passive treatment, and as Sherry said, it's what we refer to as the bucket of technologies, and there's a group of them under passive treatment. And given the fact that wetlands were at the site, we had data to show that the wetlands were being effective at removing metals, they decided that this was what they wanted to pursue. So now at this point in the decision tree, you would click on the constructive treatment wetlands, and it goes to slide number 52, which gives you the technology overviews. And again, this just also highlights the existing ICRC guides on constructive treatment wetlands. Now, as Sherry mentioned, these technology overviews have a variety of sections. They're all the same format, so it makes it easy for you to compare, and Doug will highlight that when he looks at these technology overviews in the next case study. So if we talk about advantages, then we talk about limitations. And so on slide number 53, one of the things that you have to remember for constructive treatment wetlands is that they require space. And that's one of the trade-offs when you go from active to passive. I mean, in active technologies, we can build this plant in a fairly small footprint because we can optimize the reactions, and we're pumping in energy and chemicals. You know, when you start looking at doing this in a natural setting, it takes some time, and takes time requires space. And so you need to have some area to work with. And in the early stages of constructive treatment wetlands, one of the problems was that people didn't want to have spend money to have more space, or they didn't have the space. And, you know, some of the things failed. Again, it wasn't the problem with the technology, it was the problem with the implementation and design. So, but that's an issue that will, for those of you who want to go further and do the biochemical reactor training on Thursday, we'll spend some time talking about some of those issues because it's again, passive biochemical reactors is a passive technology, and again, the same kinds of limitations apply. So, there wasn't enough area for all of the specific heaps. So we had to do something else. So the thing that made the most sense was try to reduce the amount of water that we had to treat. So if we could reduce the flow, then maybe the constructive treatment wetlands would work. So we had to go back and look at what we could do with the solid mine waste. And so Sherry mentioned, too, that, you know, you can kind of go between these decision trees, or sometimes you have to go through them multiple times, or you go through them sequentially like we're going to do this afternoon. All right, so let's go to slide number 54, and we're going to enter the solid mining waste decision tree. So the first question is, do we have sediments that are affected by mine waste that we have to deal with? That's not really an issue. This is a stockpile issue. So we'll go to slide number 55. Do we have to control exposure to mining waste which has been transported indoors? Again, no nearby residents. This is coarse rock. Air dispersion is not of major concern here. And so the answer to this one is no. And we'll move to 56. And again, as Sherry mentioned, these are designed to move you relatively quickly. And so we're not going to spend a lot of time on these slides because it is designed just to kind of say, yes, no, keep going. Do we have exposure in the residential yard? No. No one lives here. So that's not an issue. Is it feasible to remove the mine waste? Well, almost anything is possible, but is it feasible? No, I mean, it was 50 million tons, and You know, again, hopefully at some point in the future, if copper nickel mining starts, some of this rock might be able to be reprocessed, but at the time, that was not an issue, so we couldn't do anything. We had to deal with it in place. So let's go to slide number 58. Can we control a problem by treating the mine waste? And what this meant is actually doing something to the rock itself. Could we make a dust reactor? And that photo in the lower left is some experimental work that we did at the DNR, where we were using chemicals that were designed to passivate the sulfide, so actually react with the sulfide to make it less reactive. And, you know, it worked pretty well in a small laboratory setting, such as shown in that photo, where we could kind of control the application. You know, these are big stockpiles. You know, they're anywhere from 80 to 120 feet high. They range in size from, you know, sand to silt up to pianos. So, you know, applying this at some kind of scale, that scale, when it had not been planned in the beginning, was going to be very problematic. You know, there are some things that, new things that we're looking at now that might have provided some measure of control, but they were not available at that time. So, the answer to that one is no, and let's go to slide number 59. Can we control this by some kind of physical barriers? Okay. And so, can we divert water? Can we limit water getting in? And this photo here is kind of showing some drainage dishes that were installed on top of this stockpile. So, that was something that was feasible. Again, you know, these stockpiles were placed way before anyone realized it'd be a problem and people were looking at, you know, where are they sitting in the watershed. You know, with new mines now, that's one of the first things we do is siting and trying to manage our mine waste so we don't have these kinds of problems. But again, 1962, who cared? So let's go to slide number 60, and we're down to that bucket, which includes diversionary structures, capping covers, and grading. So at this site, both of these technologies were used. That photo in the lower left, kind of hard to actually see how deep it is. It does kind of look like a canyon, and it is. It's very deep. We call this the mother of all ditches, or as some of the workers at the mine used to call it, it was the mine manager who will remain unnamed, Folly, because it's a million-dollar ditch. It was very, very expensive because a lot of it had to be excavated in bedrock. That's explained in the case study document that's on the website, but we're going to talk specifically about the capping covers and grading for the presentation today. So on slide number 61, we're going to look at capping covers and grading and what we've done at this particular site. So what we did is we kind of looked at the stockpile and classified them, and that's what that graphic on the right side shows. So the red zones are obviously, those are the hot zones. They're either producing acid drainage or based on the sulfide content of the waste, they have the potential to produce acid drainage. So that's the biggest threat to water quality. The yellow, they're producing circumneutral drainage with moderate levels of metals, and they, based on their chemistry, there's a very low probability that they produce acid in the future. And then the gray, essentially, those did not contain sulfides, so there really is no water quality problem. So based on that analysis, then, different types of covers were designed. You know, soil cover, much less infiltration reduction, but a much lower cost than a membrane cover. And again, these costs are probably early 90s when the mine actually started to go into closure mode. So, but again, if you remember some of those pictures, these are stockpiles that have angle of repose with side slopes. No place to flatten, no way to really flatten those out, no way to cap them. So we could only cap the flat portions of the stockpile. All right, so let's go to slide number 62. a photo of the geomembrane that was put in at the site. It was a 40 mil low density polyethylene. And again, this was placed on those isolated hot zones, the red zones that were in that last figure. 63, again, what we had to do is, you know, to keep the water from infiltrating on the top, but you had to get it off the stockpile, kind of like the parking lot problem. So you gotta route it away. And so what was done is these huge culverts basically were installed to get water off the top, the capped part of the stockpile, but would not run to the side and infiltrate into the stockpile. Slide number 64. Let's talk a little bit about how well this worked. So again, this is the stockpile where we put on the low-density polyethylene. It's a photo in the lower left. In the upper left, then, there is the result of before and after. This is average flow. So, you know, roughly about a 70%, 60 to 70% reduction in flow before and after. So pretty good. Again, we couldn't cap the side slopes, so we couldn't get a much higher reduction of flow, which you typically get with a geomembrane that's installed properly. We also got a concentration reduction, and as a result, when you combine the concentration and the flow, you get a mass reduction. So the mass is shown up in the upper right side, an overall mass reduction of 94%. So concentration went down, as shown in the lower right. Flow went down, as shown in the upper left. They combine to give you a very nice reduction in mass relief. But if you look at the concentration, even though we really reduced the concentration substantially from around 4 milligrams per liter to less than 1, the nickel standard at the time was 0.2. So we still needed to treat the water because the nickel concentration still exceeded the standard. So let's go to slide number 65. Just a summary, we still needed the constructive treatment wetlands, which is what we decided initially, so that was good. But we've come a long way, and now we have a lot less water to treat and a lot less mass to remove. So let's go to slide number 66. This is just an air photo. Again, this shows the five wetlands were put in at each of the five distinct point source inputs that we talked about earlier when we were talking about the problem at the site. So slide number 67, this is just some photos kind of the before and after construction. This is a legacy site. A lot of these wetlands were built in areas of existing natural wetlands. Some of those natural wetlands had already been impacted by the mine drainage. That's where we actually had started to learn about how well these wetlands could actually remove some of the trace metals in this drainage. For a new operation, you would have to build something specifically designed to treat your water. You would not, in general, be allowed to use the existing wetland. So let's go to slide number 68. This is some wetland treatment performance data. So I always like to preface this one, you know, some of you may know the Reader's Guide to the Scientific Literature, and when someone says, I'm going to give you some typical results for how well my system's working, the warning lights should go off, the red flags pop up, that means this is the best data we have. And so I'm going to admit that right up front. This is the best systems we have. These systems are working just great. They've been operating 20 years, you know, treating mine water successfully. I think they are the oldest successful wetland treating metal mine drainage in the country. And if someone has data to suggest that there are others, I'd love to know it because, again, this is kind of one of my passions and hobbies. But, I go to mine sites, they go to passive treatment systems. So, yeah, my kids are right. I need a light. But the data here is just, it's really good. I mean, you can see that the bars on the left are the inflow, and the bars on the right on those two bar charts are the outflow, and we are essentially meeting the standard of 0.2 milligrams per liter nickel, which is what they designed to do. So some of the other systems, you know, it wasn't enough. Despite the fact that flow was reduced, there still just wasn't enough size, and we'll talk about what that meant in just a few slides. All right, so let's go to slide number 69. Actually, it's this next slide. And Sherry mentioned, we talk about, in the guidance, we talk about regulatory issues. We talk about, you know, some roadblocks, you know, flexibility, is that possible? And so it was here at this site. Again, this is a legacy site, you know, and there wasn't any really acute problems in terms of toxicity. The initial standards, the initial design, the 0.2 milligrams per liter nickel that I've been discussing up to this point, that's a chronic standard. And so that's what the original design was based on, that meeting that chronic standard. So, again, all systems remove the metals, but not all systems consistently met those very low chronic standards. And so there were some discussions with the Pollution Control Agency. So there, in Minnesota, there are two regulatory agencies. I work and now volunteer for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. The water quality and air quality standards are managed by our sister agency, the Pollution Control Agency. So there was some flexibility, and they said, okay, well, you know, we're going to look at a final acute value rather than, you know, chronic standards. And so the effluent cannot be acutely toxic. And actually, the summation of the individual metal toxicities that are incorporated into a formula. And even with some of that, two of the systems have some problems from the recessional issues. And so there are some variances in the existing permit. My guess is, I think there's a move that those variances will be, you know, changed in the next permit and removed. But as part of the granting variances, you know, there had to be some additional monitoring to ensure that these variants were not really adversely impacting the natural resources of the area. So there was additional toxicity testing and additional stream surveys that were required to be done as part of the new permit. So I think that takes us to slide number 70, which takes us to our first question and answer break, and I will yield the floor to Juliana.
Thank you, Paul. For our phone line participants, you are welcome to ask questions out loud. You do need to unmute your phone by selecting #6 in our system. And, of course, everyone is welcome to send in questions using that orange question mark button at the top of the slide. Do we have any questions to start from the phone line audience? Our first question refers to slide number 12. So if you're in the clue-in version, along the left is a list of slide numbers, and you can use that to jump back to slide 12. In slide 12, picture number 2, it appears that the color associated with the drainage is due to iron release, either by soil groundwater is flowing through or direct iron leachate from the soil's tailing. Is this true, or is there another red-colored waste that is part of mining waste contamination?
Juliana, I can't remember, was Sherry bailing out early today or early on Thursday?
Today. So Sherry's...
Today, okay. All right. I was waiting because this is her slide. I'm not sure of the specific source of this slide, but this is fairly typical when you see acid mine drainage. Often water is released, you know, comes out of the ground clear, and because most of the iron is ferrous. As soon as it's exposed to oxygen, it starts to oxidize and reacts upon ferric. The ferric precipitates out, and we have essentially this type of precipitate. So this actually is from a specific mine site. You're right, though. I mean, I've been in areas where you just see natural groundwater, and you also get the same phenomena because the iron is in a reduced condition where the groundwater leaves and enters the stream. It becomes oxidized, and you'll see, you know, usually much smaller areas of localized, you know, iron oxyhydroxide precipitation. So, but this is actually from a mine site, and I don't specifically know the source It might be in the speaker's notes, but I'm not certain. But again, this is a fairly common thing that we see around sites with acid mine drainage problems. And I know there's another photo in here that shows, you know, again, a very similar colored water to this at a different site.
Our next question refers to slide 45. In slide 45, the decision tree path suggests that there is nothing that can be done at the source. Is there no consideration of reducing loading at source? If not, why not? Closure and reclamation approaches and solutions should consider a source pathway receptor model that appears to be ignored here. Can you comment on this?
Okay, and I think I tried to highlight this because in retrospect, we always get done and say, you know, we maybe could have done this better. But as I tried to highlight, really the operative word here is eliminate. And, you know, source control is really one of the major things that you do when you're looking at the entire site. And so here, we really couldn't eliminate it. You know, it was not something, we couldn't completely cap it. And even when you completely cap it, I used to joke when I worked for the state is that, you know, all liners leak except ours. But the reality is they all do. And so there's always some residual water. And so, you know, for two operations, we're really trying to design them so we don't have that residual treatment component. But here, you know, because the stockpiles had those big side slopes, you know, there really wasn't anything that we could do to eliminate them. You know, we are looking at different ways of source control. Now we have a lot of, I think, fun ideas and innovative approaches, but a lot of them are still, you know, still kind of on the drawing board. We haven't demonstrated any of them on a full-scale site yet. So I think that's kind of what the specifics of this question really in the decision trees are really driving at. You know, is it something you can just say, I don't need to deal with water. I'm just going to the solid waste side and just dealing with it. I think, you know, there is this interrelationship between these two trees because the problems are so interrelated. So I don't know if I'm really good at going on and on, but if I don't answer your question, just feel free to follow up. So, but that's, I think that's kind of a little bit of background, and I think that's kind of the way of viewing it.
Our next questions refer to slide 68. The removal and effluent quality shown on slide 68 are not too bad, but didn't the contaminants result in concentrating them in aquaculture and flora? Has there been leakage measurement studies done for the flora?
Okay, so let's see. So, I agree. I think I agree that these are not too bad. I'm a little more forceful. These are pretty darn good. So, but you're right. Anytime we deal with wetland treatment, the question is, okay, where do these metals go? So they don't just disappear. And this is common in any kind of water treatment. We are removing these metals, and we've done a fair amount of work to figure out, you know, where are they going. So almost all of them go into the sediment. They're associated with the peat substrate. So, and we are concentrating them in the site on the right side. The photo on the right there, we've done a fair amount of work in that particular wetland, and we have seen nickel concentrations in the sediment at about 2%, which is about 10 times better than the nickel in the ore. So, again, we are concentrating these. We've looked at, are these tightly bound? And the answer to that is yes. They don't come off readily in kind of synthetic leaching procedures. So we've done some work with kind of the FP, something that would mimic the synthetic precipitation leaching procedure. We've done some work with kind of, you know, groundwater to see what happens. So So it's a very strong reaction that goes primarily in one direction to the substrate. We also think, and this is something that we are trying to demonstrate at that particular site, that over time, the forms of those metals change. So we've done some selective extractions. We know that the initial removal mechanism is primarily, you know, binding to the organics through some kind of complexation, chelation reaction, you know, ion exchange. I mean, there's a variety of mechanisms that occur with heat and trace metals. But over time, as in an anoxic environment, there is this process called biogenesis, which those would then hopefully convert to a more stable sulfide form and then be even less available. Now, it doesn't mean that the plants don't accumulate them, and they do. They don't biomagnify. There is some elevated levels in some of the plant species. But this whole area of northeastern Minnesota is fairly, a lot of it is shallow to bedrock. Mineralization is reflected in soils and peat soils and in vegetation in other areas. So there is some elevated concentrations, you know, but there are natural zones that also have elevated concentrations. Again, from a visual impact status, you know, again, you know, I'm an engineer, I'm not a biologist, you know, we have done some surveys of these wetlands with biologists, again, looking at a growth scale, you know, there's no gross impact here. There's obviously a lot of aquatic life. And again, that's something that we also hope to go into this wetland with the high concentrations and do some additional work. Again, and the other thing here, and boy, this is a topic I can obviously roll. You can give me the hook anytime, Juliana. But you know, you have to look at which metals you're treating and the potential for in biological impact. So, you know, copper, cobalt, nickel, and zinc. You know, certainly they have toxic effects, particularly on aquatic organisms, but they're not the really bad actors like, you know, lead and cadmium, things that, you know, there has been, you know, there's been wildlife death from ingesting sediments rich in lead. So again, there's those metals when you have those kinds of toxicity, depending on what levels you're treating, you know, constructive treatment wetlands may not be the best, or maybe not a surface flow. You might want to use a subsurface flow or a vertical flow where you're concentrating those metals in a zone that's not biologically acceptable. Okay, I'll stop rambling, but, you know, again, if that doesn't answer your question, if you have more, just, you know, you feel free to follow up.
Thanks, Paul. And please do continue to send in questions if you do need further follow-up. We have a few questions that we have not got to yet, but we'll try to get to those at the end of the training. For now, I do want to wrap up this question and answer break. Also a reminder, if you leave before we finish up today, we still want you to fill up that feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. We'll continue on now with the next section of our training class, and on slide 71, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Doug Bacon of the Utah Department of Environmental Quality. Doug?
Thank you, Juliana, and kind of like Sherry, just to double check, am I coming across okay?
You sound great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Continuing the discussion on slide 71, Paul and Sherry have provided an overview of the guidance document and in more detail how to work through the decision trees. What we're going to take a chance now to do is walk through a case study using the Bingham Canyon Mine here in Utah and talk about the type of information you can gather from the technology overviews and the case studies themselves to help select a technology that may be in one of those bucket lists at the end of the decision trees. So moving on to slide 72, I'm going to take some time to introduce the site and some of the detailed information that, even though these decision trees came into existence after the remedy was selected for Bingham Canyon, you can still see how the information would have been useful if the decision trees had been made available, if the technology overviews had been available. So the Bingham Canyon Mining District pretty much represents a good swath of the Ochre Mountains stretching from Butterfield Canyon north to the Great Salt Lake. It's a mountain range with approximately 96,000 developable acres, It's about 18 miles as the crow flies to the southwest of Salt Lake City, as demonstrated here on the map. On slide 73, we're going to focus on, in terms of the case study, groundwater impacts. But I just want to introduce what were the sources of the mining-influenced water. And I will right now acknowledge that these sources have some various source control measures that were implemented. We won't focus on that information, but certainly it's available if there are any questions about such. One of the main sources of groundwater influence in the southwest portion of the Salt Lake Valley was the storage mechanism for the waste rock that was produced by the Bingham Canyon mine since its inception. The mine has been operating for a little over 110 years, continues to operate to date. Waste rock is still managed as it was in the past by stockpiling it around the open pit. Currently, there's about 4 to 5 billion tons of sulfide-bearing waste rock that used to be actively leached in the past. Both meteoric leach water as well as active leach water generally had a characteristic of about 100,000 milligrams per liter total dissolved solids, about 60,000 milligrams per liter sulfate concentration, a pH of about 3.5, and various concentrations of trace metals that were in exceedance of state drinking water standards. Prior to environmental regulations, most of this water was allowed to flow out into the valley aquifer. On slide 74, another source of mining-influenced water were a series of reservoirs constructed by the mining company from the 1960s to the 1990s until they were taken offline. They were used to contain the process waters and storm waters that were flowing off of the Bingham Canyon mine itself and the waste rock dumps. Again, they generally had a characteristic of about the same quality of water as acid mine drainage. Again, approximately 100,000 milligrams per liter TDS, 60,000 milligrams per liter sulfate, very low pH of about 3.5. The interesting thing is the reservoirs were not lined, because again, they predated most environmental regulations, and they were found to leak approximately 1 million gallons of water a day. So in terms of acting as a good source control measure, containment measure, they were not. On slide 75, just to introduce you to the two historic legacy groundwater plumes. Operable Unit 2, which covers these two plumes, the Kennecott South Zone is comprised of two distinct plumes, as noted here. We do have a series of about 400 monitoring wells that have characterized the nature and extent and have determined that they are not connected. The case study used today does focus in on Zone A, so I'm going to keep the discussion on Zone A during the remainder of the training. As you'll note here on slide 75, Zone A is multicolored. As you get into the darker green, the yellows, the orange, the reds, sulfate concentrations increase. Along with an increase in sulfate concentration, you do see an increase in metals concentrations. You see a decrease in pH, just as an example in the areas that are denoted with red, pH in the groundwater system is about 3. You also see elevated TDS. With the understanding that these groundwater plumes underline a significant population of the Salt Lake Valley, the state initiated some assessment work in the 80s and 90s to determine what was the extent of impact, what could be done. And the principal reason for this is in the state of Utah as well as most of the western United States, groundwater is a significant resource for drinking purposes. And as it was determined through early on assessments, the impacted aquifer, represented here by the two plumes, equated to approximately 1/4 of the drinking water needed for the Salt Lake Valley. Now, the plumes underline the communities of West Jordan, South Jordan, Riverton, and Harriman, Utah, and are our principal source of drinking water to those communities. But while they've been impacted, their use for that purpose has been prevented. So kind of moving away from introducing the case study, if you're presented with a particular environmental problem, like the groundwater plumes, and you are going to go into the guidance document, you can work through those through the decision trees and work question by question down to eventually the list of bucket technologies. What we do emphasize, and hopefully we have emphasized sufficiently today, is you really ought to enter those decision trees or go directly to the technology overviews with a good understanding of your site, the problem presented by the site, and really the criteria associated with the problem and what needs to be done well in hand. Again, utilizing the Zone A groundwater plume as a case example, we understood that once the groundwater was extracted, it was at that point that it posed a human health risk. And there were private extraction wells as well as municipal extraction wells within the region of the Zone A plume that could intercede and extract that plume water. Again, it has high TDS and sulfate. On average, it ranged from 2 to 20 times the primary drinking water standards that the state of Utah has established for both of those contaminants. But again, we wanted to reemphasize that the groundwater plume is about 300 to 650 feet below the current surface grade. So really, it is once the water is extracted that it poses a human health risk. Some other considerations that were involved in that particular project is back in about 86 to early 90s, the state of Utah decided to file a natural resource damage claim against the principal party, Kennecott Copper. As part of that settlement agreement, it was determined that Kennecott could propose a project in the future that would make use of the groundwater that's in the Zone A plume and treat that groundwater to ultimately produce an equivalent volume that's been impacted for drinking purposes. That equivalent volume was determined to be 3,500 acre feet per year, which equates to about 1.1 billion gallons per year. To put that into further context, an acre foot per year was roughly assessed to be the same amount of water a family of four needed for a one-year time period. Now, we could jump into the decision trees and use those to ultimately get down to a list of technologies. Just real brief, starting with the mining influence water decision tree. Again, noting that it is a groundwater problem represented in Zone A. Really, the human receptor is what we're trying to protect in this particular example. And so we would boil down or scroll down through the decision tree by answering that first question of the mining influence water tree down to the receptor, which moves us on to slide 78, giving us a bucket list of technologies, including administrative and engineering controls, pressure-driven membrane separation, and ion exchange. That's one way to get to those technologies. Another would be to, with an understanding of your site, really just kind of get into the technology overviews. Perhaps you're in a position where you've already done some technology assessment and you have a general sense that you need to do treatment that's actively attaining drinking water standards for the public. So that you kind of have a general sense of what may or may not be effective for that activity. You can jump into the technology overviews, and really the three key sections of those overviews to key in on are the applicability, the advantages, and the limitation sections of each technology overview. And in the next couple slides, I'm going to really zero in on the type of information you can find in those three sections using the case example of the Zone A groundwater plume and demonstrate how that information that's in those sections would have helped narrow the list down to the technology that was selected for the Bingham Canyon mine. So jumping into the administrative and engineering controls technology overview, again, reviewing the applicability, the advantages, and limitations sections, one would find that, first, administrative engineering controls do not necessarily directly remove the contaminants. Often these are institutional controls, like a drilling restriction, put in place to prevent the public as well as municipalities from, you know, an example of a Zone A plume, drilling a new extraction well or moving a point of diversion into the regional aquifer that could then eventually start to extract that groundwater without any treatment. The restriction just prevents drilling. It doesn't really remove the contaminants. It ultimately transfers treatment costs to well owners that do eventually get their application to sink a drinking water well or to move a point of diversion in, because as they move that well into that location and they start experiencing the production of water coming from the plume, they're going to have to address how that water is used, and that will lead to having to do some treatment. Administrative and engineering controls also don't prevent migration. They don't act as containment. And thus the plume, which has been shown to be migrating over time, absent any active extraction and treatment, would potentially migrate to the predicted pathway, which is to the central portion of the Salt Lake Valley, into the Jordan River pathway, and moving north into the communities closer to Salt Lake City. Another interesting thing that came to mind as we were developing and reviewing the administrative engineering controls in this particular case study is that often the solid-state contaminants that are in the aquifer, if they're not being flushed out through the active extraction of groundwater pore volumes, that solid-state contaminant mass will remain in place as well and continue to act as a potential source for ongoing introduction of those contaminants to the groundwater itself. In reviewing the ion exchange technology overview, again, those three key sections, we would find that initially ion exchange does not reduce TDS appreciably. It does exchange the ions that are in the water, but it doesn't reduce TDS, which was one of the contaminants that the state filed its natural resource damage claim against. So unless we could find another mechanism to reduce TDS, ion exchange wasn't going to work. We've also found that depending upon the volume of water that needs to be treated and the standards that need to be attained, ion exchange and the cost for building such a plant wasn't as efficient as the cost associated with running a more traditional treatment plant. Also, there are going to be some disposal limitations that are denoted within the ion exchange technology overview that in this particular case study were a bit problematic. So moving on to the third listed technology in that bucket list, pressure-driven membrane separation, I will first acknowledge that it was the technology selected. If we had the technology overview at the time, some of the points noted here on slide 82 would have been the reasons for its selection. One is it is an active treatment, and so there is some cost there, but it can appreciably remove the sulfate and TDS concentrations as well as any other metals concentrations that may be in exceedance of the state's primary drinking water standards and attain those standards at a cost-effective rate. It does clean both aqueous and solid phase contaminants from the overall aquifer system. The way it removes the solid phase is by drawing pore volumes of groundwater out of the aquifer. Fresh water is allowed to filter down into the aquifer. Mixing amongst the solid matrix, it will redissolve the solid phase contaminants that are absorbed to the soil particles, and then when that pore volume gets pulled out and subsequently treated, the solid mass of contaminants are ultimately removed from the aquifer. As I said earlier, it can attain the applicable drinking water standards at the volumes that were required to be treated and produced under that natural resource damage claim filed by the state. Pressure-driven membrane separation is also a tested and tried technology. It's been utilized by the drinking water industry for quite some time. So understanding its effectiveness was well understood when it was originally selected. Some further information, which I'll go into later, as it pertains to the case study documentation, we understood that there was a location we could dispose of the concentrate from this technology. One thing to understand is it does produce a brine stream, which is noted in the limitations section. That brine waste product or byproduct can be problematic in terms of disposal locations. In our particular case, with the Zone A flume, we had a readily available disposal location that could effectively manage that brine stream, and I'll touch on that here in a minute. Moving on to slide 83, the technology overview for pressure-driven membrane separation goes into some further information that sometimes could be helpful for selecting the technology over another technology. In the case of PDMS, easier way of saying it, there is a discussion on the types or the classes of pressure-driven membrane separation, which include microfiltration, ultrafiltration, nanofiltration, and reverse osmosis. It was reverse osmosis that was ultimately selected for treatment purposes at the Zone A flume. The information that you can find as exemplified by the PDMS technology overview will go into, again, for the membranes, the solutes that they reject, the operating pressures, configuration options that might help you to understand the effectiveness of this technology for application at your particular site. On slide 84, just to kind of recapture why we chose RO at the Zone A groundwater plume. One, reverse osmosis only allows water molecules to pass through. It does remove a wide range of contaminants of concern. It can attain drinking water standards, as noted earlier, and it has a recovery efficiency of around 75%. All of this information is presented within the technology overview for pressure-driven membrane separation in the applicabilities section. Some other criteria that, again, falls back to what's understood about the site specifically. Again, it was required that a certain volume of 3,500 acre feet be produced, and based on that volume that needed to be produced, RO treatment was selected as being the most efficient at the time. And again, we had an existing and functional disposal facility for the brine stream produced by RO. Now, that's the type of information you can find within the technology overview. You can also use the case studies as another source of information that can help you narrow down the list if you eventually get to the bucket list, or if you happen to just jump into the guidance document and want to start selecting a technology for use. In the case studies that are associated with each technology overview, you can find information about contacts to get further information that may not be presented. You can find performance data on the particular technology, cost data if it's been made available, the challenges that have been presented by a site, the stakeholder challenges as it pertains to selecting a remedy and working with the public, and there's often reference information for further literary search or as you contact a project manager, you can reference that information to assist with gaining more information from the individual. As it pertains to pressure-driven membrane separation technology overview, there were two case studies included, one being the Bingham Canyon Water Treatment Plant, the Zone A, that's treating the Zone A groundwater plume, and another being a coal mine in southwestern Pennsylvania. But other technology overviews have a wider range of case studies that might exemplify in a real-world scenario more information that can help determine the applicability of using the technology at your site, because each site represents a different set of specific requirements that can help narrow down the list on which technology to use. On slide 86, In the subsequent slides hereafter, I kind of want to go into the tech or the case study for the Bingham Canyon Water Treatment Plant, exemplify some of the information that that case study includes, just to give you a sense of what's in there and how that information may be useful to narrow down the selection of a technology. So introducing the Bingham Canyon Water Treatment Plant, demonstrated here in photo number one on the left side. It is a facility that made use of the pilot treatment plant footprint. It took approximately 2 years to construct. It's been in operation since May of 2006. The overall operation includes both pre- and post-treatment as well as the reverse osmosis systems. In slide or photo number two on the upper right-hand corner, you see the two reverse osmosis treatment racks. What it was determined to be effective for the Zone A plume is that each rack is treating about half of the volume being extracted from the Zone A plume and ultimately produced for drinking purposes. The feed water entering the treatment system moves through a first stage series of treatment through a set of six horizontal vessels that are in columns. The product then moves on into post-treatment. The byproduct of the first stage becomes the feed water of the second stage. Then by making use of anti-scalant that's entered into the feed water prior to going through the RO membranes, the pressure differentials are kept to a minimal. The system operates under an initial input of pressure. It is effective to treat the contaminants. Now, one of the key things and what is documented in the case study for this particular project is understanding the quality of the feed water is very critical prior to using a pressure-driven membrane treatment system. The quality of the feed water really is going to drive the design of the facility and the need for post and pre and post treatment. And what was understood with the Zone A groundwater is it comes out of the ground with a fairly high calcium concentration, gypsum concentration. And so one of the things that is done, as demonstrated in photo number three, and just barely in view past the six stainless steel bag and cartridge filter vessels, are two carboys, white carboys, that introduce an anti-scalant to prevent the gypsum from scaling to the membranes. Because if the concentrations of gypsum that's in the groundwater were to go through the membranes without that anti-scalant, they would attach to the membranes, block the pore space of the membranes, and thus reduce the efficiency of treatment. Kind of information is made available in this case study, and it exemplifies kind of the information that you can find in all the other case studies. Some further information that's provided is looking at removal performance. As we noted, RO generally by industry standards has a 75% removal efficiency. As it pertains to TDS with the Zone A treatment plant, what we found is TDS removal efficiencies averaged about 98%, which is well above industry standards. We do see an overall treated water production rate of about 75%. There are times where Kennecott Utah Copper is able to get that treated water production rate up to about 78% removal efficiency. It really depends upon the quality of the water, and that's some information that's presented in the case study for the Bingham Canyon Mine Water Treatment Plant. Slide 88, I noted earlier that there were some lessons learned, and that type of information is also included in the case studies. As it pertains to the brine produced or the byproduct produced by reverse osmosis, it generally is going to be fairly elevated for your salts, hence why it's called brine. It will have, as noted here in the graph, a fairly high TDS, as well as a fairly high sulfate concentration. Generally speaking, this type of water is very problematic from a standpoint of discharging it to a freshwater body. In the state of Utah, we generally, other than rivers and streams, We generally don't have other places unless you're building an impoundment for such water to go to. And as we studied the site and understood the available technology or available facilities that were being operated by the mine, we looked at the geochemistry of the mine's tailings pipeline, which delivers tailings from their mill to an impoundment constructed near the south shoreline of the Great Salt Lake. We looked at the geochemistry of the tailings. We looked at the characteristics of the brine stream. We looked at the volumes. And as part of that study, we assessed that the pipeline itself, as well as the overall impoundment, could facilitate the disposal of the RO concentrate, which represented approximately 2% of the overall volume that typically flows along that tailings pipeline. And that the solid mass of contaminants that are associated with the RO brine stream could be captured within their tailings impoundment and stored permanently. I will note that the tailings impoundment was, and continues to be operated in compliance with the groundwater protection permit issued by the state of Utah, surface water discharge permit issued by the state of Utah, as well as an air quality permit. Understanding the site, understanding the facilities that are available, and then understanding the waste products being produced by a particular technology are all critical lessons to be learned. And in this particular case example, that information is provided in the case study. I got to acknowledge, not every case study will go into this detail. Some are more detailed than others, but this is just an example of lessons learned that you can find. On slide 89, another lesson that was learned from just understanding the use of reverse osmosis is reverse osmosis does produce a very low mineralized water. It will have a fairly low TDS concentration when the treated water is produced, as you can see by the graph, below 50 milligrams per liter. That low mineral content of the permeate or treated water can cause for the corrosion of older drinking water systems if the water is sent out for delivery through those municipal systems. The reason for that is that that low mineral content, the water will corrode the older pipes that are metallic to remineralize itself. As a function of trying to prevent that, since we didn't have control over the provision systems, the pipes and the containment facilities that the water would be purveyed through, we recognized that by bypassing some of the treatment operation, the reverse osmosis to be exact, and treating that small volume of bypass water that's coming from the wells, which is bag and cartridge filters and UV disinfection, we could remineralize the permeate, bring the TDS concentration back up to what was established as the compliance limit under the state secondary drinking water standards for drinking water systems, which is 250 milligrams per liter, thus removing the potential for the treated water to corrode the pipes of older systems. Again, just an example of information that's presented about lessons learned. Now, you might ask, just to kind of close up the story about the case study for Bingham Canyon, case studies in general, we will often talk about cost effectiveness in the case studies if that information is available. As noted, the treatment plant at Bingham Canyon has been in operation since May of 2006. I present a snapshot of some of that operational activity in terms of production volumes here on slide 90. The bang for the buck, the overall treatment plant costs $15 million in capital, and it costs approximately $1.2 million annually for O&M. 40% of that O&M cost is labor. The average recovery rate over the time frame of 2006 to 2010 was about 73.8%. That recovery rate has been increased since the case study was drafted. But just to note, that's another example of information that's provided in the various case studies. Moving on to slide 91. In summary, you can use the guidance document in two methods. One, working through the decision trees, answering the questions about your site, you'll eventually narrow down the list of technologies that might be appropriate for your site. And then ultimately, you're going to have to go through the technology overviews to understand the applicability, the limitations and the use of that technology. In this case, you can also jump into the technology overviews directly, as well as the case studies directly, as I exemplified just now in this last section of the training. On slide 92, just before turning back over to Juliana, we've provided a background on the mining issues that typically are found within the country. We've provided an overview of the guidance document, the components of the guidance document, including the decision trees, the technology overviews, case studies, and regulatory issues. Paul used the Duncan Mine as an example to walk through the decision trees to show you how you can use those. And hopefully, I provided some information on what's captured by the technology overviews and the case studies that might benefit you as you work through deciding what technology might be appropriate to use at your site to address either your solid mine waste or your mining influenced water problems. Would note, as we noted throughout the training, we do have a training coming up on May 22nd on the use of biochemical reactors for mining influenced water, and we welcome you to consider attending that training. It will focus in on that specific technology and its application and how to design and use it for addressing mining influenced water at a particular site. And with that, I'll turn it over to Juliana for any questions that the audience may have.
Thanks, Doug. And you're welcome to start sending in questions using the orange question mark at the top of the slide. Before we get to those questions, on slide 93, I do want to take you to our links to additional resources and our feedback form. So you're welcome to select either area of the slide. If you do go to our links page first, along the left under the Clue and Sun, the third button down takes you to the feedback. We do appreciate if you just take a few minutes now to give us your feedback. Looking at the links page, download today's IPRC training. That's going to allow you to download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. In addition to what's on the slides, there's more information available in the notes section in this downloaded version. We introduced today the IPRC web-based mining waste technology selection site. So that next link takes you over to the IPRC website where this resource lives. We've also mentioned the new document and training biochemical reactors. So the next link takes you to that web-based document, and then following that takes you to the internet-based training page. So if you are interested and haven't registered already, that fourth link down takes to a link of the page where you can look to the upper right and register for the class. We include additional resources from ITRC in Section 1. There's actually many more ITRC resources available, so I encourage you to visit the website, the ITRC website. In Section 2, we've mentioned a few additional websites and documents, and we do include these here. This page will continue to be available for you as a reference. We now want to get to as many questions as we can. We have plenty of time at the end. We're scheduled to go to 15 minutes after the hour, so we hope to get to all of the questions. For the phone line audience, you're welcome to ask questions out loud. Remember, #6 to unmute your phone. So unmute the phone at your location and #6 to unmute. And for the simulcast or anyone who wants to, it's back on the slides, that orange question mark button that allows you to send in questions. Do you have a question to start from the phone line? From the simulcast, we have a question that refers to slide 86. Slide 86, is there a treatment process schematic that shows the treated water flow and waste produced flow schematic?
In the case study itself, we did not include a schematic on the flow process, or process flow. In some design documentation that is referenced in the case study, process flow schematics are noted and available. That's where it's helpful to review the reference section on the case study.
For the Binghamton Canyon case study, one, where was the treated Zone A effluent discharged? And two, did Bingham Canyon perform pilot studies prior to treatment selection?
Okay. Yes and yes. In terms of where the Zone A treatment plant effluent is sent to, again, through some geochemistry analysis of the mill tailings, as well as other process waters that are sent to the tailings pipeline, the Zone A RO concentrate or brine or byproduct, whichever term you want to use, it's all one word, waste material, is sent to Kennecott Tailings Pipeline. It is a pipeline that, again, emanates from the Copperton Mill, which is north and west of the treatment plant. The tailings pipeline traverses approximately 17 miles to the north, where, as demonstrated on slide, let me find it, I believe it's slide 88, the overall combined material in the pipeline is discharged into the KUC North Tailings Impoundment, which is Kennecott's active tailings impoundment. The RO brine represents 2% of the total volume within the pipeline itself, which conveys both mill tailings, acidic waters that are managed from other other sources located at the mine site, as well as water that's extracted from the core of Zone A that's not necessarily treated, except for through neutralization that takes place within the pipeline itself. As it pertains to pilot treatment, yes, Kennecott did perform pilot treatment on a number of different pressure-driven membrane separation technologies to assess the effectiveness on treating the groundwater in Zone A. Pilot treatment took place between approximately 1999 up until about 2003. Then Kennecott and its partner formulated its proposal to make use of a trust fund under that natural resource damage settlement to then ultimately produce from treatment using reverse osmosis. But during the pilot treatment processes, which I could go into a lengthy discussion of, they looked at nanofiltration. They looked at combinations of nanofiltration and reverse osmosis. They looked at even combinations of ion exchange and reverse osmosis. They knew that they needed to focus on a high volume of production, and hence why they were focused on pressure-driven membrane separation technologies, again, to attain the strict drinking water standards of the state. If that isn't totally a sufficient answer to your question, happy to take any follow-up questions.
Including all cost, what is the average per gallon cost of treating the water in the Binghamton RO system, treatment system?
I don't know if I... That's a good question. I'll have to follow up on it, mostly because I don't have dollar per gallon treatment cost in the top of my head.
I've noted it.
Juliana, if we can record that, I'll follow up on that question.
Great. I have noted it. We had a few questions left on the first question and answer break. So related to the Dunk of mine, what type flow does a passive treatment system handle?
I'm sorry, Juliana. What type flow? Or?
Yeah, I would say what amount of flow.
Okay. So, let's see. They do range. They pretty much are designed to handle that whole range of flows that were discussed when we could summarize the problem. So, you know, the small ones are 5 to 10 gallons per minute, and the biggest flow averages around 250. You know, and some of those, you know, obviously peak at you know, several times that average amount. But again, you know, again, there's not really a limit to the amount of flow you can handle if you have the space. So it's about having the faith and then designing them so that you have the contact time in the area that you need to get your metal removal.
Great. As a follow-up on that, what size area was that larger passive treatment system that the slide had a photograph of?
That's a good question. And I have those numbers, but it's not something that I have on the top of my head. So, again, I can certainly send you that information. It's actually from some publications that we did kind of talk about all five, and I could certainly send you, if you want to send us an email, I could certainly send you a copy of that, and that kind of gives all the gory details. So, or I could just send you the area of those systems too, but it might be easier if you do the whole thing. So.
And the person asking the question, is that Marianne from South Carolina?
Yes.
I will note that as a follow-up. Thanks. For the Dunca camping, the high sulfide areas of the waste pit, was the mass reduction seen at the seeps?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that one?
For the Dunca camping, the high sulfide areas of the waste pile, was the mass reduction seen at the seeps?
Yes, it was. I mean, that was the way we were determining the mass reduction. We just had one. We were monitoring essentially the main seep from that area, and we just looked at the flow and the concentration changes there.
So we have a couple more questions about slide 68, and you may have covered some of it before, but I don't think you got all of it. So back on slide 68, what are the differences?
My typical performance?
Well, no, you definitely covered a lot of answers on slide 68. What are the differences between the wetlands shown in the pictures? And you may have answered that. And do the water quality results change in the non-growing season?
Okay. So they essentially were designed in a similar manner. So, and I don't know if you can see it. Just going to refer to an earlier slide here. But these were essentially designed with a series of berms that were put in to help kind of control the hydraulic gradient. And those were just glacial till or soil berms. And then there was a substrate, which new substrate was placed. So these are, as I mentioned, these were built in existing wetlands. And so essentially the first thing they did is they essentially cleared and grubbed the vegetation. Then they put in berms periodically to control hydraulic gradient. And then they put in a substrate mixture that was part peat from an area they were stripping at another mine site. And then they mixed this in with a waste product from the horticultural processing of peat, which is they call screenings. And so that this is, it's kind of the long fibers and maybe some wood fragments. And the idea was that they were trying to kind of increase, you know, the permeability, open up the peat a little bit so that there'd be better contact. So that's kind of the basic design for all five systems that were put in at the Dunca mine. And so, you know, and some of them actually have a little more open water, like the photo on the left has a little more open water than the one on the right. So there are some differences in the way they actually kind of matured in the actual construction. So that's kind of so they're all basically constructed the same way. And, I mean, one of the reasons to put in the kind of new substrate is that, as I mentioned, you know, we had seen some elevated concentrations in the existing wetlands, and also this is a way to try to better distribute the flow so we got better contact and better removal. Winter operations. So in general, what we see here is that the seeps tend to freeze. This is northeastern Minnesota. And so, we don't have a whole lot of data on winter performance. At one of the sites, it does tend to flow year-round. And at that particular site, we see a decrease in performance, but we believe it's primarily due to the fact that what happens is that we get a channelization. You know, at 20 below zero, you're not going to keep the big flatland open, but you're going to, the water will find a way. And what you can see is in the winter at this site, there is actually kind of, there's an open water because that site flows at about 20 gallons per minute. So, you know, in general, in kind of normal years, the whole wetland is not quite open because you do see this one small pathway where the flow is going. And so essentially the removal goes way down because you have no contact. So, you know, the mechanisms will, since it's primarily a chemical bonding, yeah, those reactions tend to slow, but it's not like a biological reaction where you really, really, where it's much more sensitive to cold temperatures. So again, that's something that you're going to treat water and you do have something that's flowing year round. You need to consider that in your design. And so, you know, sometimes people will either have a factor where they can adjust the water level so that they can build up ice and then flow water underneath it, or they might look at, again, a vertical flow wetland or a subsurface flow wetland. Again, you're providing that flow beneath the surface, and then you can afford to let the surface freeze. So, again, there's some design things that you can employ depending on your site, you know, and your water quality and your climate.
What do the concentrations displayed in slide 68 represent? Are these different flow regimes? Also, what are the O&M requirements for the constructed wetlands to ensure continued function?
Okay, so the concentrations on slide, so these are average concentrations. And it's just the inlet, you know, concentration into the wetland and then the outflow kind of at the permit monitoring point. And so that's what those concentrations are. The O&M, again, it really has been pretty minimal at these sites. You know, and there's a little more when they first were built, you know, until they got established, the vegetation was established, flow paths were established. There were some problems with some of the initial berms. The berms would settle, so they actually changed construction techniques, you know, as they built more of the wetlands to minimize that settling problem. And then really it's, you know, probably one of the, and it depends on the, you know, you have to do, again, these are what we say with passive treatment systems. They are not no maintenance systems, but they are low maintenance. And so periodic inspections, you know, when they go to monitor, they'll just look and make sure that, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, beavers are a problem in northern Minnesota. You know, these two sites that are slide 68, I don't think we've had much beaver issues there. There are some V-notch weirs, and sometimes vegetation will get caught in the weir, and it has to be cleaned out. There has one of the weir inputs had some, the beavers decided that was a good place to build a dam, and so they dam up the V-notch weir, and then they increase the water level. You know, actually, this is in the pipon that was feeding the wetland. I don't think we've not had any particular, you know, beaver activity in the wetland itself. So there has been some muskrat activity, but again, not so much that they totally decimated the area. So again, it's really been, after they got established, it's really been very, very minimal.
Back to the Bingham case study, RO efficiency is normally thought to be temperature sensitive. For the Bingham RO treatment process, how temperature sensitive is it, and at what temperature range is it being operated?
The Bingham Canyon Mine treatment plant is actually internal. It's within a building that's temperature controlled, comfortable standards of air temps for the staff workers. The restriction on its use pursuant to climatic temperature was not a consideration as it pertained to designing the treatment plant, because the treatment plant is heated. It's operated year-round, so in the wintertime even though we tend to go through cycles here with mild winters and fairly cold winters with a lot of snow, since 2006, our winters have been fairly mild. We haven't had any issues related to running the plant due to temperature restrictions. It probably is not the best of answers, but I can say, including the treatment operation inside a temperature-controlled plant is effective if you have the space and the capital investment to put into building such a facility.
Thank you. We're out of questions from our simulcast audience. We do have those couple noted that we'll follow up on after the class. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you have not already filled out that feedback form, please take just a few minutes to give us your feedback. We really do use the information. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, which is www.itrcweb.org. And once again, we have another training class on Thursday. If you are planning to join us, please be sure to note the time. It does start earlier on Thursday, so please join us earlier. Thanks again, and have a great day.